Did you fucking listen?
The old woman called.
Look, lady, I done told you. I don't know who in the hell you're talking about. I ain't seen anyone come in here. No one just walks in, as you can tell, Rick said.
My boy come in here to see Randall. Where's he at?
The skinny man asked. Rick looked over at me. I just shrugged. Rick looked back to the gaggle on the other side of the logs and said,
He ain't here anymore.
The old woman squinted an eye, and her upper lip curled up over her two top teeth.
Where'd they go?
Rick shrugged.
Don't know. They're just gone.
If my boy ain't home tomorrow, we'll be back, she said,
as she turned and headed over to an old Suzuki Samurai that I hadn't noticed. I was surprised that the thing would actually run. The skinny man got behind the wheel while the other two climbed into the back, and that woman got in the passenger seat. It started with a loud rattle and headed off down 19 into the forest.
Where are they from? I asked Rick. I don't know. From the looks of them, I would guess a rock out in the damn woods somewhere. You seen anyone around here? Their kid, maybe?
I thought about the body I had seen draped over Reggie's four-wheeler.
Nope, haven't seen a soul.
Rick looked as though he didn't believe me.
Jeff said, Gabians.
I said, what?
Gabians were fortifications used during the Civil War. Their baskets filled with rocks or dirt and stacked up to form defensive positions. That's what y'all need here.
I was thinking about that when Rick said,
I've seen those. That's a good idea.
It'd provide a lot better cover than these logs. I don't know what we'd make them out of, though. I said,
we could use that stand of river cane back near Reggie's house.
River cane would work real good.
Use whole stalks for the verticals and split halves to weave around them. That'd work great,
Jeff said, nodding his head.
How big do they need to be? Rick asked.
Jeff rubbed his chin for a moment.
Probably 3 feet in diameter would be enough.
Damn.
That'll take a lot of cane and a lot of dirt to fill, Rick said.
And a hell of a lot of manpower to complete. Just moving the dirt to fill them would be a hell of a job, I added.
Well, these fuckers ain't doing anything else, Rick said, nodding over his shoulder toward the neighborhood. If they're not going to stand guard, they sure as shit can help make sure we don't get shot doing it for them.
We went on to discuss the logistics of such an undertaking, and whether it was even worth doing. We could only block the road here. The rest of the neighborhood could be entered from the rear of any of the houses. Then we talked about whether or not the folks in the neighborhood would even help do it. I doubted that they would do anything to help out. Some would, but the majority of them wouldn't. They didn't even help man the barricade. Rick said he would talk to Mark about it, and asked me to go check out the stand of cane in the morning. Jeff said he'd go with me, and Thad, Jeff, and I headed back to the truck. I helped the guys unload the wood on their back porch, the closest approach to the fireplace. The lamps made a huge difference. Having my solar set up enabled me to use the lights in the house, and I hadn't gotten used to how dark the nights were without them. Over at Thad and Jeff's place, I was able to see just how dark it was. With the aid of the lantern, it was no big issue to get a fire going. There was already quite a bit of kindling in the house, and a large box of Strike Anywhere matches. I told the guys to come down in the morning for breakfast, and left them for the night. As I was heading home, I slowed at the side road that Reggie lives off of. I thought about going down there to look at the cane, but really, I wanted to go talk to him about his passenger and our visitors. Instead, I went home to spend some time with Mel and the girls. The girls were already in bed by the time I made it back, so after banking the fire with a couple of logs, I headed off to bed, where I found Mel buried in a pile of blankets. After a breakfast of tasty casserole, Thad, Jeff, and I headed down toward Reggie's house. As I was getting in the truck, Little Bit came out, wanting to come with us. I told her to wait a bit, and she could go with me later. I didn't pull into Reggie's drive, instead stopping the truck at the end of the road where the stand of cane started. The three of us got out to look it over, trying to figure out if there was enough there to make what we wanted. While we were talking, Reggie came down the drive.
What's up, guys?
Hey, Reg. We're We're thinking of using the cane for something, I said.
What?
Between Jeff and I, we explained what we were thinking of doing. Jeff offered a pretty fair idea of the design of the gabions, how we would need to split some of the cane to weave in around the whole stalks. In the sand, I drew a rough sketch of how we could set them up to improve the log barricade. When I finished my chicken scratch in the dirt, I stood up and waited to see what Reggie thought. He was standing, thinking, reaching up and rubbing the stubble on his chin. I looked at his hand as he scuffed the beard on his face.
Instead of using this cane, why don't we use some field wire? It'd be a lot easier to make him out of. Find something to line him up with to keep the dirt in, he finally said.
Well, that's a great idea, but where are we going to get the fence?
Start taking it down, Thad said.
I've got 10 rolls of it, Reggie replied.
What?
Where'd you get all that? I asked. I got it at an auction months ago. I was going to replace a bunch of the fence here and split fence the pig pen back there.
Reggie jutted a thumb over his shoulder in the direction of the pasture.
Reg, you have pigs? I asked.
Yeah. I moved them into the barn to keep them out of sight. There's 7 sows and 1 boar in there. I'm waiting for them sows to drop their litters. I know a couple of them are almost ready.
Holy shit, that's a lot of bacon, Jeff said.
That could sure help out some folks, if you're willing, I said. Reggie looked at me with a slight squint.
Morgan, I ain't going to just give the meat away. There's a shit pile of people here who ain't lifted a finger to do a damn thing around here. Hell, most of them are just in their house starving to death instead of doing anything about it.
He paused for a moment. But those folks who are working to keep things going are more than welcome to it.
I think you know where I stand on that particular issue, Reggie, I said.
How many people are back here? Thad asked.
No one's ever done a count, but we guess there are probably over 100, or there were anyway, I answered.
With that many bodies, you guys should be able to get all kinds of stuff done around here, if everyone was working together, Thad offered.
Reggie looked over at the big man.
Well, that's just it. No one has really tried to organize a real effort to do anything.
Who's in charge around here? Jeff asked.
Reggie and I looked at one another. I guess Mark kinda is, I said. I'd been thinking about the baskets and what to line them with while we were talking, and had an idea. What if we used some tar paper to line the baskets with?
Reggie said, I have a few rolls of that too. That would work real good.
Jeff said, that's perfect.
I said, I have a few rolls, too. I did half the roof earlier this year, and had bought enough paper to do the whole thing, so I have a bunch.
Well, then it sounds like we got a plan. Let's get to work. Morgan, back your truck up to the shop there, and we'll load as many rolls into the back as we can. It'd be better to make these at your place, since it's closer to the end of the road.
In the morning, we met back at Reggie's, and I backed in as Thad and Jeff followed Reggie up the drive. Reggie opened the big doors in the front of the shop, and I was able to back the ass end up into it. They were already rolling the wire out when I got out. I went to the back of the truck, stood a roll up, leaned it over the back, and hefted it up into the cargo area. Reggie came up and helped me muscle it in.
Hey, Reg, what happened to your knuckles, man?
I asked, nodding at his hands on the roll of wire. He just looked at me, then at his hands. He stood there and thought for a moment and said,
Follow me.
I followed him out a back door of the shop as Thad and Jeff moved another roll of wire past us. Reggie went to the barn and opened a padlock on a small door. He hung the lock on the hasp and turned to me.
Before you say anything, hear me out.
He opened the door and stepped into what, at one time, was a tack room of sorts. The early morning sunlight cut through the open door, lighting up a rectangle on the floor. It took my eyes a second to adjust to the dimness of the small space. What I saw caught me off guard. In the center of the room was a man tied to a chair, a rag of some sort over his eyes. An old wool blanket was draped loosely over his shoulders. He had a flannel shirt on over a blood-stained t-shirt. He was unconscious, and what I could see of his face told me why.
Reg? Who the fuck is that?
Remember we found that ID in Randall's room?
Yeah, but...
He cut me off.
This here is the one who helped Randall. They killed them girls. They raped, tortured, and brutalized them.
I looked at the figure in the chair, then back at Reggie. You sure about that?
Reggie nodded. I even got the names of the other girls. He knew where they were dumped, too. Remember the tire tracks that Mark drew a picture of?
I nodded, and he said, I didn't need a damn picture of them. They were super swampers. He waved for me to follow him. I followed him as he headed for the back of his property line, following a very obvious set of tire tracks. At the edge of his property, under an old green canvas tarp, was a red Nissan pickup, sitting on a set of super swampers. Reggie pulled the tarp back over the bed and stood there, looking into it. This was the last place she was. She's probably alive in here, before they did what they did to her.
Reggie, you positive about this?
He nodded.
I said, how'd you get the truck back here? No one saw it.
He told me that he and Louise had been at the barricade when the kid came by looking for Randall. Reggie didn't like the look of him the moment he pulled up and started to talk to the kid. From the conversation they had, he knew the kid was involved with what happened. I asked how he got him to his house, and he said he had caught the kid off guard with an uppercut to the chin. He loaded the kid up and took him home on his four-wheeler, then went back for the truck, driving it around through the woods to the spot at the back of his property.
What about Louise?
I said. He knew my niece some. He won't say nothing. Reggie pulled the tarp back over the truck, and we headed for the shop. When we got to the barn, Thad and Jeff were standing there, looking in the open door.
What's this, Morgan? Thad asked.
I looked at Reggie. You tell him. Reggie gave the Cliff Notes version of what led up to the kid being tied to the chair. While he relayed the story, Thad kept his eyes on the kid in the chair.
I guess this is who they were looking for, huh? Thad said, once Reggie finished.
Reggie looked over at me with a question on his face, and I told him about the encounter at the barricade the night before. Thad looked at Reggie and me and said,
if he did it, then he needs to be dealt with. You can't let anyone find him here.
Is he still alive?
Jeff asked, and Reggie nodded.
I guess we can bury him, Reggie said.
Thad looked past Reggie and said,
them hogs in the barn here.
Reggie looked a little confused.
Yeah, in there.
He jutted his chin toward the end of the barn. Thad said,
Morgan, we got five rolls into the back of the truck. Why don't you and Jeff head to your place and start on the baskets?
Gabion's, Jeff said.
Gabion's,
Thad corrected himself. What are you guys going to do? I asked.
Thad said, Morgan, from what you have told me about things around here, you don't need any more shit on your head. I'll help Reggie do what he needs done, and we'll come down in a little while.
The way Thad spoke surprised me. He had changed, and I didn't have to guess why. I looked at Jeff and jerked my head toward the shop. He followed me to the truck. Chapter 27 Sarge looked out the open door of the Black Hawk at the Apache off the starboard side. He leaned back into the web seat with a smile on his face and closed his eyes. When he had retired from the army, he thought he would never sit in one of these vibrating monsters again, but here he was. This was what he had missed, what he had tried to find out there on the airwaves of the world, the camaraderie of brothers in arms. He opened his eyes and looked around at the faces of the men with him, men who had chosen to fight the good fight. Captain Lewis met his eyes, and a smile cracked his face. His eyes shifted, and Sarge followed them out the open door. They were crossing the fence line of Camp Riley. Smoke rose from several places around the base. Farther off in the distance, they could see the airbase, and there was smoke there as well. Sarge looked back to the captain and pressed the PTT button on his intercom.
Looks like they put up a fight,
Captain Lewis replied, while still looking out the door.
Still are. We're mopping up right now. Look out there.
Sarge followed his outstretched arm to a small runway. On the apron, in front of a hangar, were dozens of men sitting in the asphalt. They were on their knees, with their hands on their heads and their ankles crossed. Standing around them were several other men. A loose ring of camo uniforms contained a fidgeting mass of black ones. Sarge could see a couple of camo uniforms walking amongst the captives, probably looking for the ones they wanted to interrogate.
"What are you going to do with all of them?"
Captain Lewis said, "I don't know what the plan is, but I think there's plenty to keep them busy." He finished with a smile.
"Look at all them jackbooted thugs," Mike said, looking out the door.
The Black Hawk was descending toward the runway, and the Apache banked away and flew across the base. As the Hilo approached the deck, a ground handler came out holding two small orange wands and began to give hand signals to the pilots. He was wearing the regulation earmuffs and goggles. Ted saw this and thought,
"Even under the current circumstances, the Army is still the Army."
The wheels touched the deck and took the load of the big bird. The pilots started to shut down the power plant as the ground man gave them the signal to kill power. Captain Lewis and his men bounded out of the ship with Mike, Ted, and Doc in tow. Sarge levered himself out of the web seat and went to the door, looking out at the activity. Here he was, over 50, and about to get back in the Army. A grin cut his old face, and he shook his head. Reaching out to brace himself in the door, he took a deep breath, and First Sergeant Linus Mitchell stepped out onto the asphalt of Camp Riley.
"What are they going to do to him?" Jeff asked,
as I turned the Suburban off Reggie's road.
"Not sure, but I could guess," I replied.
"Look, you know I'm going to need you to keep this a secret, right?" Jeff said,
"Hey, man, what you've done for me, I got no problem keeping my mouth shut."
"I get that, but I don't mean it's an obligation, because I helped you out. I need you to trust me. This neighborhood's seen some bad shit, and truth is, the guy who's supposed to be in charge is refusing to deal with it."
"You mean Mark?"
"Yeah. He's not a bad guy, but he's not making the adjustment, you know? That guy's a murderer and a rapist. We're not going to let him run around loose while Mark figures out how to have a trial or something."
"I get it, man. You got three girls."
"Yeah, that's it, exactly. I'm not some vigilante, Jeff. It's just..."
"I get it, Morg. I get it. You can count on me."
"Thanks, man." I was heading toward Danny's house. We were going to need his help with this. At Danny's, Jeff hopped out and opened the gate and closed it after I pulled through. Danny was in his shop working on a tiller when we pulled up.
"Yo!"
he called out as he walked up.
"Hey, man, what's up?" I said.
"Not much. Just tuning up the tiller. I'm going to try and till the garden and build a greenhouse over part of it. Hey, Jeff, how's it going?"
"SOS, man. SOS, Jeff said.
I told him what we had in mind, and he asked if he could come help, and he agreed it was a good idea. I asked if he had any tar paper, and he said he had three or four rolls lying around. We went into the little tin building where he kept the tractor and lawn tools. In one corner was a pallet with a few bundles of shingles and three full rolls and one partial roll of paper. We loaded the paper up into the Suburban while I went in to tell Bobby he was coming down to help. I pulled the truck up to the walkway and waited for him. He emerged from the house with Bobby in tow, and they climbed into the back seat.
"You coming to help too?"
I asked Bobby as she climbed in.
"I'm coming down to help Mel supervise," she replied with a smile.
"Oh, that'll certainly help," I said with a laugh.
"No shit," Danny added. And Jeff laughed as we headed for the gate. I drove the truck around the back of the house to be closer to the shop, and as soon as I stopped, Mel was coming out the back door with the girls in tow. When the girls saw Danny and Bobby, they ran up to them. Mel came up to me while the girls were giving their hugs and said, "You need to go over to Howard's house. His wife came over earlier looking for you."
"Is everything all right?"
"I don't know. She wouldn't really say. Just that you needed to come over. What's her name? I can't remember it." I thought for a moment, but couldn't remember her name.
"I can't remember either. Guess I'll go over and see what's up."
Jeff asked if I needed him to come, and I told him no. He said he was going to dig my rolls of tar paper out and load them in the back with the others.
He said the same thing I was already thinking, that it would be better to build the gabions out at the barricade so we didn't have to try to move them. Jeff and Danny went out to the woodshed, where I told him the roles were, and I hopped the fence that separated Howard's and my yards. His wife saw me coming and had the door open as I came.
"Hello, Morgan," she said.
"Hi, is everything all right?"
"Oh, yes, come in, come in."
She held the door, ushering me inside. I found Howard in a bedroom he used for an office. His radio was set up in there, and he was sitting in front of it, with his leg propped up. I walked in and sat in a chair beside him. He smiled and said, "Hey, Morgan."
"What's up, Howard?"
"I thought you'd like to hear what's going on."
"What have you heard?"
"It isn't so much what I have heard as what I haven't." He paused, looking over the top of his glasses at me. "I haven't heard anything from the feds at all, but there's a lot of talk out there about what they're doing."
"Well, what's Uncle Sugar up to?"
"From what I've heard, they're moving people, lots of people. No one seems to know where or why, but that's what they're doing. The most interesting thing was a guy up near Fort Bragg talking about a big firefight going on at the base."
Skeptical, I asked.
"What?
They fighting each other?"
"Don't know. All I know is what I heard." Taking my hat off, I rubbed my head through my hair.
"You said they were moving people? Know anything else on that?"
"I heard some nut job saying something about a executive order that gave the Postmaster General the right to go out and round people up or some shit. I think he's batshit crazy, but he sure ran off at the mouth about it. Could you imagine the mailman showing up and telling you you had to leave? What would he do? Whack you with a magazine if you didn't?" He laughed.
"I don't know. Right now about anything is possible, I guess. How's the leg?"
Howard's face soured, and he lifted the stump off the little stool it was resting on.
"Okay, I guess."
The gauze was soaked with blood and fluid. I said, "Let me see it, Howard."
"You don't need to fool with it. I'm all right."
"When was the last time you changed the dressing?" I asked, as I knelt down to inspect the leg.
"Been a day or two, I reckon."
As I got close to the leg, the faint putrid smell found its way to my nose. I said, "Damn it, Howard, you have to change it every day. The doc did a pretty good job, but if you fuck around and let it get infected, there isn't shit we can do about it. Where's the dressings and stuff the doc gave you?" Howard fidgeted in his seat, but I gave a look that told him I wasn't going to let the issue die.
"Phyllis, can you bring them bandages in here?" he called out through the open door.
In a moment, she came in the room carrying the box the doc had given us.
"Here it is."
"You guys need to change this every day. It's really important," I said.
"Oh, I know, Morgan. It's just that there isn't much in here. If we change it every day, we'll run out pretty quick. We thought we could go a few days in between."
"Don't worry about running out. You can take the old gauze and boil it and reuse it. As for the bandages, I have some. And there are other things we can use, too. Cut up an old sheet and boil it and use that. Hell, we can use maxi pads, too."
"Maxi pads?" Howard shouted.
I looked at him and said, "Think about what they do." He just screwed up his face. I pulled on a pair of gloves from the box and started to unwrap the gauze, then remove the bandages. It didn't look good. In the box, there were a couple of betadine scrubs, and I asked Miss Phyllis to bring in a big bowl of water. Once I had the water, I used a scrub to clean the stub of the leg. While I'm sure it hurt, Howard never complained, though he did tense up a couple of times. I made them promise to change the dressing every day, and once they promised, I headed for the door. I asked Miss Phyllis about their wood situation. She said they had plenty and not to worry about them. I told her I would check back in a couple of days and headed back to the house. I felt like I was getting too caught up in putting out fires. It's not that I didn't want to help folks out, but the big stuff, the long-term stuff, kept getting put off. There was hardly time to even make plans about what we should be doing and preparing for. I found Jeff and Danny inside eating lunch and sat down to have a bite myself, along with some tea. Mel and Bobby were sitting in the living room with the girls. Danny asked how Howard was, and I told him about the leg. He said we needed to keep an eye on him,
Then I told them what Howard had heard on the radio, and we all agreed we needed to keep an eye out. If it was true that they are forcibly relocating people, that could be an issue. Danny asked if I had checked on Miss Janice. I told him I hadn't, and that we needed to. He volunteered to do it later that day. After lunch, we headed for the barricade. Danny found the tools we needed, and Jeff had loaded the paper up, so there was nothing left to do but get to work. We had assembled four of the Gabians when Reggie and Thad showed up. Danny was inside one of the baskets, tying the paper to the inside. We had laid the baskets over on their sides to make it easier to get in and out of. Jeff and I were unrolling wire when Thad walked up.
"Looks pretty good. Gonna take a lot of dirt to fill him, though," Thad said.
Looking up from the roll, I said,
"Yeah, that's gonna suck.
Weren't we talking yesterday about how some of the other folks around here could pitch in?"
"Yeah, we were," Reggie said. "But you know, and I know, that's gonna take an act of God to organize. I'd rather do it my damn self. Shit, if we had thought of it before, my nephew might still be alive."
We nodded at that. Reggie said,
"I got an idea that'll speed it up. I'll bring my tractor down, and we can scoop the dirt up in the bucket and bring it down here and dump it in."
Jeff said, "I like the way this guy thinks." The five of us got busy and had assembled enough of them to cover the road in a couple of hours. The two guys that were guarding the barricade were all excited about our little project. After Lance and Reggie's nephew had been killed, everyone was nervous about being out on security. The logs provided little protection. They were designed to keep cars and trucks out, and there were precious few of those around now. I was lying in one of the baskets, pushing pieces of tie wire through the paper so Reggie could twist them off. When he stuck his head in the end, I said, "What's up?" He stood there for a minute, looking at me. I dropped my arms and propped myself up on my elbows.
"You all right?"
Reggie hesitated for a tick and said,
"Yeah. Your friend there? Thad?"
He motioned with his head in Thad's direction. "He tell you what happened to his family?"
"No. He didn't seem to want to talk about it, so I left it alone."
"Why?"
"We're just curious. I couldn't do it. I wanted to, but I couldn't."
Again he hesitated, looking back down the road in the direction of his house.
"But he did. I could never have imagined something like that."
Now he had my attention. "Like what? You mean kill that kid?"
"It wasn't the killing. It's what he did after."
"And what was that after?" Reggie dropped his head slowly, shaking it back and forth.
"Let's just say I ain't gonna have to feed them pigs for a while."
I looked at him. For an instant I was confused. Then it struck me. "He fed him to the pigs?" Reggie nodded.
"I've been around them pigs since the day they was born, but they didn't hesitate. He cut them open, and when they smelled blood and guts, they went right to it. God, it was awful."
Reggie stood up, hands on his hips, and looked over at Thad.
"That man right there scares the shit out of me."
I climbed out of the basket and stood beside him.
"Well, at least he's on our side."
"Huh, no shit." With all those baskets assembled, we gathered around the back of the truck and were shooting the shit. I told everyone what Don said about being forcibly relocated. Jeff laughed it off, and Danny said they could have his asshole but nothing else. That got Jeff and I laughing until Thad cut us off. He said, "Don't laugh." I looked at him.
"Don't laugh about it. Best thing to do? If you see a damn mailman, you shoot his ass on sight."
Suddenly all the funny was gone.
"Why is that?" Danny asked. "It was a mailman who came to my house. Him and a DHS security man."
Thad looked off to the southwest.
"They killed Anita and Tony."
We all looked around at one another, everyone except Thad. His gaze was fixed out there somewhere. When it was clear he wasn't going to say any more, Danny spoke up.
"Hey, why don't we have a fish fry at my house tonight?"
That brought Thad back around.
"Fish fry? You got fish?"
Danny smiled.
"Yeah, but we gotta catch him first."
"And that isn't hard either," I offered. We all agreed a fish fry would be a nice diversion.
Danny had a small pond at his place, and it was full of bluegill. The girls had spent many an evening out there with bread balls and cane poles catching fish. But before we could run off to play, we had to finish the task at hand. We set the baskets up just behind the log barricades in a staggered line. The first one was set at the edge of the road, and the next one was set just in front and beside it. The third was set just behind and beside the second. This overlapping provided complete coverage, ensuring that a bullet couldn't find its way between two of the baskets. Doing it this way required more gabions than just setting them side by side, but it created a much more robust defense. We had to assemble three more to complete the position, and by then, it was starting to get late in the afternoon. Everyone started to drift off toward their houses, agreeing to meet back at Danny's in an hour. Danny rode back to the house with me. Coming through the front door, we were met with an incredible smell. "Damn! What the hell are y'all cooking?" Danny called out as he headed for the kitchen. I followed him in and saw a big pot sitting on the stove just as Mel answered, "Beans." We told them what we had in mind, the fish fry, and they were immediately excited. It was something we used to do a lot during spec season. Mel and Bobby went about whipping up some cornbread real quick. The stove was already on, so it wasn't a big deal to throw the oven over the burner and get it heating while they mixed it up. I went and rounded up the girls, telling them we were going down to Danny and Bobby's for a fish fry, and that they had to catch the fish. That got them excited, and there was a sudden flurry of bodies running around the house, getting ready to leave. Since there was no bread for bread balls, Danny broke out a can of corn. We'd set some aside for bait and used the rest for dinner. Danny kept several little cane poles in the rack that held his canoe beside the pond, and it didn't take long before the girls were all catching fish. The fish bit as soon as a hook hit the water. It was all Thad, Danny, Jeff, and I could do to keep the hooks baited and take the fish off. None of the girls were into that, though I was sure that would change. There were 9 people to feed, but we culled some of the smaller fish, which were many, and that told us the pond could keep producing for some time. When the fish finally stopped biting, we had 21 nice bluegills. Mel and Bobby were inside getting things ready. We were going to cook the fish on Danny's turkey fryer using a Dutch oven filled with oil. As was the tradition, the menfolk would cook the fish. Normally, we would fillet the fish, but things being what they were, I wasn't about to waste any meat, so we simply scaled and gutted them and cut off the heads. Thad said he preferred them this way. He liked the tails turning all crispy. Taylor and Leanne went inside with their mom, and Bobby with Little Bit came out to help, touching the eyes and poking the guts as they were pulled out. With the 4 of us working, it didn't take long before all the fish were ready for the oil. Danny already had it set up with the burner going and the oil heating when I carried the bowl of fish over. He had set it beside the picnic table and had all the stuff to season the fish set out on the table. Thad said that he loved to fry fish and told us we wouldn't be disappointed if we let him take over. Not being one to hold a working man back, we stepped back. Thad went in the house and came back out with a couple of bottles of spices and a paper bag. He poured cornmeal and some flour in the bag and seasoned it, then added the fish one at a time and shook them in the mix before taking them out and lowering them by their tails into the hot oil. The look on his face was hilarious. His lips were pressed together as if he was whistling, though no sound came out. "Oh, this is gonna be good," he proclaimed, after lowering the 5th fish into the oil. The rest of us started to laugh. Danny had set out camp chairs, and we were sitting around shooting the shit. It was another one of those instances of normality, if you didn't add in all the rifles leaning around the picnic table and the fact that we all wore pistols. I got out of my chair and went to the truck, returning with the bottle of whiskey we had started on the other night. Danny went in the shop and came back with some Dixie cups, the little one you see in people's bathrooms, and I poured shots for each of us. I thought to myself, I could get used to this. We joked and talked, drank and cooked, and generally enjoyed ourselves. As the fish were ready to come out, Thad would pull them out of the oil with a set of tongs and put them on a baking sheet Bobby brought out to us.
It was one used for broiling, and had a rack that held the fish above the pan, allowing them to drain. Paper towels were a thing of the past, but this worked just as well. We carried the pan into the house to a chorus of cheers from the women. It didn't last long, though. As soon as they saw the fish, they started to bitch. They expected fillets, not this. While they were still complaining, I picked up a fish by the tail and took a butter knife and ran it down one side. All the meat on that side fell off onto the plate, and I repeated the process on the other and held up the bones, still in one piece. Seeing how easy it was, everyone immediately set about filleting their own. There was cornbread, skillet corn, and a pot of beans. Everyone came past the island and loaded their plates. I was sitting in a chair on the far side of the living room, looking at the kitchen. The scene reminded me of a party, and everyone was enjoying themselves. The house was lit by the flame from the fireplace, and several oil lamps scattered around. Danny had some electric lights, but used the lamps more often than not. Thad was sitting beside Little Bit, leaning down as she was saying something to him. He had a big smile on his face and was nodding his head, and a moment later, he leaned back and began to laugh, Little Bit looking up and cackling with laughter. Taylor, Leanne, Mel, and Bobby were sitting at the table laughing about something. Jeff stood at the island, picking at the plates, eating whatever was left. That brought a smile to my face. Here was the smallest guy amongst us, and he had the biggest appetite. He looked up and saw me looking at him, and smiled as he stuck a crumb of cornbread in his mouth, licking his thumb as he did. A feast like this, and such good company, made me understand holidays like Thanksgiving better. A couple hundred years ago, there were probably only a few times a year where you could eat until you couldn't eat anymore. I knew we wouldn't always have this much in the years to come, but I was glad we could appreciate it now, when we did. If this was how life was going to be from now on, focused on family and friends, I could live with it. I thought about how much time I had used to spend on the road for work, missing my family. Things were a lot harder now, but I never went to bed alone, far away from home, and wondering what they were up to anymore. Turning my attention from Jeff, I stared into the fireplace. The smile on my face faded as I watched the flames dance. I knew in my heart that this surely was not how life was going to be from now on. This was merely a moment of peace and happiness in an uncertain world. But why couldn't this be the new normal? Why did we have to suffer and worry? If we put our minds to it, as well as our backs, this could be the way we lived. The thoughts were still bouncing around in my head when I heard the first shot. Chapter 28. Sarge followed the other guys into a large hangar. Passing through the huge open doors, he saw several rows of tables set up, with uniformed men and women sitting around them. Captain Lewis was off to the side, talking to another man, and Sarge noticed when the captain gestured in his direction. He walked over to where Mike and Ted were setting their gear down. At his approach, Mike looked up. "What now, boss?" "I have no idea, and from the looks of things, I ain't your boss anymore," Sarge said. Mike looked at the officers, then back to Sarge. "Oh, hell. You ain't gonna let those guys take over, are you?" Sarge looked at the guys for a moment before speaking. "Look here, fellas. You're back in the army now. I suggest you get back in that mindset. I don't know what they're going to do with me, but you boys are still property of the good old U.S. government." Ted dipped his chin in the direction of the officers.
"Looks like we're about to find out."
Sarge looked over to see Captain Lewis and what turned out to be a bird colonel heading his way. Sarge snapped to attention.
"Attention!"
he shouted as the men approached. Mike, Ted, and Doc all immediately followed suit. The colonel smiled and stuck out his hand as he approached.
"At ease, gentlemen. First Sergeant Mitchell, I'm Colonel Fawcett. We spoke on the radio."
Sarge reached out and took his hand.
"Good to meet you, Colonel."
Colonel Fawcett looked at the guys standing behind Sarge.
"This your crew?"
Sarge glanced back over his shoulder and said,
"Well, I wouldn't say they're mine. I'm sure they probably belong to you, but when I found them,
I knew they shouldn't be without constant adult supervision.
The colonel smiled.
First Sergeant, I know you're retired now, but I need your help. Are you willing to come back aboard and help us out?
Colonel, when I took my oath, it wasn't until I retired. It was forever.
If you can use an old man like me, I consider it an honor to help in any way I can.
You're forming a geezer brigade, Colonel?
Ted asked.
Without turning his head, Sarge said, No one's talking to you, dipshit.
I think we'll get along just fine, Sergeant Mitchell.
Can you tell me exactly what in the hell is going on, Colonel?
Let's get into that over lunch, Sergeant.
Sarge looked over his shoulder at the guys standing behind him.
These boys need some grub and probably some sleep, sir. Can you arrange that before we have lunch?
Putting your men first, absolutely.
Colonel Fawcett turned to the people gathered at the table and said,
Lieutenant Cox, can you find these men some quarters and some grub?
Yes, sir,
came the reply.
The colonel said, If you guys will get with Cox there, he'll get you sorted out.
Roger that, Ted said.
The colonel beckoned to Sarge and said, Sergeant Mitchell. After the first shot, we all looked at one another. I walked over to the front door, and in the background, I could hear some of the others moving. From behind me, I heard one of the girls ask if that was a gunshot. I picked up my carbine before stepping out the door. I was listening for any sound. The absence of man-made noises allowed the natural sounds of night to really stand out. Aside from the crickets, I couldn't hear anything else. Danny came out on the porch beside me.
Hear anything?
Nah, nothing.
That damn sure sounded like a gunshot, though, didn't it? Maybe someone got a deer like you did the other night.
Before I could answer him, another shot ripped through the night, followed immediately by another. The shots were followed by shouts and screams. The sounds were coming from the back of the neighborhood, back toward the forest, and they were getting louder. Danny ducked inside and returned with his carbine, and Thad and Jeff followed him out. The four of us were standing there in the dark, listening to the chaos, not sure of what it was, where it was, or what to do.
Look over there!
In the light coming through the window, we could see Jeff pointing to the east. There was an orange glow in the sky that was rapidly growing in intensity.
It's a fire, Thad said.
Danny dipped back into the house. I could hear him talking, feet shuffling across the floor, and all the lights went out. He came back out on the porch.
We need to go check this out.
Yeah, but someone needs to stay here, I said. Before anything else could be said, the sound of ATVs coming up the road filled the air. There were several of them, from the sounds of it, then shooting, lots of shooting. Through the trees, we caught glimpses of small flames moving fast. Danny and I took off running toward the gate. I saw movement in the yard of Danny's neighbor. An ATV with two men on it. One of them was holding a torch of some sort. As they pulled up to the house, the man in the back lit something with a torch and threw it in the roof of the house. Whatever it was rolled off the roof, spilling flames out onto the shingles as it did. When it hit the ground, the man stepped off the four-wheeler and bent over to pick it up. When he straightened and went to throw it again, there was a thunderous explosion to my right. I instinctively ducked, but realized quickly it was Danny shooting. By the time I had my wits together enough to look back, the guy was down, the little flame lying in the grass beside him. The four-wheeler was turning to head for the gate. Danny was firing at it, and I joined him. After three or four shots, the rider fell off, and the ATV continued until it hit the fence.
Look!
Danny shouted, pointing down the road where more men could be seen in the yard of another house. There was a large wash of flames running down the side of the house. Another man took a running start at the house and heaved a Molotov cocktail through the front window of the living room, and the flames lit up the inside of the house. Danny and I started to fire at them, though they were probably 300 yards away and it was dark. Our fire drew their attention. I saw one of them point, then shout at some of the others. Suddenly, there were three ATVs racing toward us. The passengers on each were firing wildly. We fired a couple of shots at them and turned to find some cover in the pine trees in front of Danny's house. As I slid in behind a tree, The first ATV raced through the gate. I thought we had closed it, but it was open. Danny started to fire at it. I joined him, and the two men both hit the dirt. The second and third ATVs had already come through the gate. I tried to angle myself to get a shot at one that was moving toward the front of the house. The passenger was standing up, one hand on the rider's shoulder, a Molotov in the other. They were going to try to run up to the house and throw it. I flipped over on my back and started firing, and then there was an explosion. The Molotov turned into a fireball, consuming the men and their machine. They fell off and writhed on the ground, rolling around trying to put the flames out. I turned my attention to the third machine. It was suddenly quiet. There was still some shooting, but it was a little farther away. We could see the one house burning and the glow from what had to be two more. The sound of the third ATV caught my attention. It was behind the house. "It's around back!" I yelled to Danny. As we ran past the porch, I wondered where Jeff and Thad were. As we rounded the house, we saw the four-wheeler sitting in front of the screen door to the back porch. Danny hit the surefire on his carbine to light it up. One of the men was lying on the ground behind it, and the second was lying on the stairs to the porch. Thad and Jeff were standing there. Thad had a bucket in his hands, and water dripped onto a black scorch that still smoked where the stairs met the porch. Jeff was holding one of his Glocks, a tendril of smoke rising from the end of the stubby suppressor.
"We got him," Jeff said.
We could still hear some ATVs running around along with some sporadic gunfire. Whoever this was, they were well equipped. "I need to go check in my house," I said.
"I'll go with you," Thad said.
We ran out to the Suburban and jumped in without saying a word. Thad had his old coach gun at the ready as I went through the gate and started down the road. The house next to Mark's was burning, and I saw Mark out in his yard as I went by. I kept my eyes open for four-wheelers, but didn't see any. My gate. It was open, and I knew we had closed it. I turned into the drive, fishtailing the old truck and slinging rocks and dirt. I floored it and took the drive to the backyard, planning to come at the house from the rear. As we passed through the gate and the split fence, I looked over at the shop. I'd modified the door in it with a half-inch thick piece of flat bar that I secured with two padlocks. It was a typical metal, shed-style building, and the door was nothing more than styrofoam sandwiched between two thin veneers of metal. This, with the bars on the inside of the windows, was the best I could do to secure the building. Two men were at work on the lower half of the door with an axe. There was already a sizable hole in the lower half, and it wouldn't be long before they could get in. I swung the truck to face the shop, and the headlights swept across it to light up one of the raiders, axe raised over his head for another strike. At the same time, Thad opened his door, the momentum of the turn flinging it open, and he stepped out while the truck was still moving. He raised his shotgun as the second man at the shop raised his rifle, an AK variant of some type, and fired as he backpedaled around the shop. His partner quickly followed him. Thad's shotgun went off as I jumped out of the truck. We ran to the shop, going wide to get as much of a view around the building as we could. The two men were running for the back fence. It was so dark we couldn't see them, but we could clearly hear their feet slam into the ground as they ran. Thad let loose another shot from the old coach gun. We weren't about to chase them in the dark and went back to look at the shop door. They had done a hell of a job on it. Chunks of foam were scattered all around the front of the building, along with torn pieces of the sheet metal cover. I was relieved to see that they hadn't made it in the shop.
"Don't look like they got in," Thad said.
"No, I don't think they did. But how did they know to hit my shop, of all the buildings out here? That's what worries me."
"You think they've been watching us?"
I thought about it for a minute. They had to be. I don't know if the attack on the back of the neighborhood was just a diversion or what, but it seems too well coordinated, don't you think?
Thad said, "You're probably right. I'll stay here. You go back down to Danny's and check on your girls."
"Thanks. I'll be back in a bit. If anything happens, just start shooting and we'll come a-running."
"Don't worry about me,"
Go on.
Driving back down to Danny's, there were people all over the road. I saw Mark and his mule racing around the houses, with Rick and his four-wheeler checking on others. As I was passing the side road to Reggie's house, I saw headlights coming down the road and stopped, unclipped the quick-release buckle on the sling of my rifle, and switched it to my left hand in case I needed to fire out the passenger window. Reggie came sliding to a stop beside the truck.
"I got one of them tied up at the house. What do we want to do with him?" Reggie said.
"Where'd you get him?"
"He was running past my place, headed for the woods. I was out in the barn trying to keep an eye on my place when I heard him coming. I hit him across the chest with a shovel as he rounded the corner. He's tied up in the barn." Remembering what had happened to the last guy I saw tied up in Reggie's barn, I said, "Well, let's get him out of there. I'll follow you down to your place, and we'll load him up in here and take him to Mark and see what he wants to do with him."
"Take him to Mark? You still beating that horse?"
"Shit, man, I don't know. Maybe this will wake him up."
Reggie said, "Yeah, okay," and took off down the road, with me behind him. We pulled up in front of the barn and found the guy tied up in the same chair the kid had been tied to. What surprised me the most about the guy was how clean and well-fed he looked. His clothes looked new, he was shaved, and didn't look like he'd been missing too many meals. And he didn't look scared either, which kind of freaked me out.
"Here's what he had on him," Reggie said, nudging a pile of gear on the floor by the door. There was an AK variant, a pistol and some kind of tactical-looking holster, a chest rig with mags, and a pack, the three-day assault style. The pack was black and didn't scream tactical until you really looked at it. He was wearing jeans and a camo jacket of some kind, definitely not military, but not Joe civilian either. Reggie had the guy's hands secured with tie wraps behind his back, and several wraps of rope secured him to the chair. I said, "We're going to take you out of the chair. I have no problem shooting you, so just walk out to the truck and we won't have any trouble. You fuck around and I'll drop you." He never acknowledged I was speaking, but we got him out of the chair and into the truck without incident. Reggie threw his gear into the back and sat beside him in the rear seat, with his well-worn Para-Ordnance 45 stuck in the man's ribs. We found Mark in the road in front of his house and showed him what we had. Reggie relayed the story of how he had caught him. Mark looked into the back seat at the man. "What the hell do we do with him now?" he asked.
"You tell us. You're the law," I said.
"I don't know what to do with him. Where can we put him?"
"How about the stocks we built?" I said.
"You actually built that thing?"
"Yeah. Danny and me did."
"Go put him in there, I guess. But someone needs to stay there and keep an eye on him. I have to finish going through the neighborhood. We have 7 dead so far."
"7? Reggie said.
Mark looked over at him and nodded.
"A couple of those are just assumed at the moment. Some of the fires are still burning, and we can't get in to look yet."
"Jesus, how many houses did they burn?" I asked.
4 totaled. 3 others were hit with firebombs, but they either didn't catch or got put out. We took one out next door to Danny. They threw it on the roof, but it didn't break, just rolled off, spilling fire the whole way. Then Danny shot that dude. You know, this sure seemed awful coordinated. Where did they get all these damn ATVs?
Mark shook his head and said,
"I don't know," then looked into the back of the truck. "But we're going to find out."
Reggie and I took our prisoner over to the stocks and deposited him in them. Reggie had an idea and disappeared down the road in a cloud of dust on his four-wheeler, returning shortly after with a 5-gallon bucket strapped to the back. He brought out a logging chain and a couple of padlocks. We wrapped the chain around the guy's waist and secured him to the 4x4 posts. Even if he got his head and neck out, he wasn't going anywhere. The strangest part of the entire thing was the fact that our new captive never said a word, never offered any resistance. It was like he was resigned to his fate and just went along with the plan. Jeff was at the gate to Danny's when I pulled up. He was carrying the old SKS he had bought for a song from a guy he worked with. He opened the gate and I pulled through, stopping beside him. "You really need to start carrying that peasant rifle of yours.
I said.
I got your peasant right here, he said with a grin. From now on, I'll have it with me. How are things at your place? Two guys were trying to axe their way into the shop, but they ran off when we showed up. Thad stayed behind to keep an eye on things. Sounds like we've been under surveillance. I was thinking the same thing. We need to get together with everyone and work out some better security. They knew not to come in the front door, and the back door was wide-ass open. Jeff said he would keep an eye out on the front of the house. Danny was behind the house, where the two had been killed by the steps. By the time I got there, he already had dragged them out to his shop to get them away from the house, where the girls couldn't see them. He had a hose in his hand, and was washing the blood off the steps when he saw me. We need to get the two from out front, he said, as he ran the hose back and forth on the steps. How bad are they burned? He looked sideways at me. Bad enough. The two men were in pretty rough shape. Whatever he used for fuel in those bottles had burned hot and long. The front yard smelled of burned cotton, plastic, and rubber. Added to this was a sickly sweet smell of burned flesh and the rank odor of charred hair. One of them had been wearing some sort of synthetic jacket, and it had melted to his skin and hardened into hunks of plastic in surreal forms. Their skin was mottled black and gray, with pink and white showing where blisters had formed and ruptured or where the heat simply split them open like overcooked hot dogs. We used Danny's four-wheeler to drag them to the back. The ATV they had been on had suffered bad damage to all the plastic body sections. The seat was gone, two of the tires had burned pretty badly, and most of the wiring was scorched. It would be useless, except as parts. Danny was inspecting it, then looked up to where the one that we shot the two riders off of had stopped when it ran into the fence. Hey, man, these are all the same model. The colors are different on these two, but they're the same. I looked over to the one tangled in the fence, then at the other one. Even with the fire damage on the one in front of us, it was obvious they were the same. I said, it's weird. Maybe they hit a dealer or something and stole all of them. Maybe, but there isn't a dealer anywhere around here. They would have had to come from Leesburger or Ocala or farther, Danny said. I guess you're right, but now I have a four-wheeler. I'm going to go get that one, I said, and pointed over to the fence. As I started to walk away, Danny called out, how much gas do you have at your place? I said, I have a drum with some, don't know for sure, but with this many new machines around, we're going to need more. Maybe tomorrow we should go up to the Kangaroo and see if we can trade for some gas. Danny said, sounds good to me. You take that machine. We'll give this one to Jeff and Thad, and I'll keep the burned one for spare parts. It's got the same motor that mine has. The four-wheeler was still in gear and running, sitting against the fence. I saw some blood on the seat. Swinging the light back across the pasture toward the house, I didn't see a body. I sure thought we'd shot the guy off the thing as he was trying to run, but I drove it toward the house. There was a body there. Back at Danny's, we talked about the bodies and agreed to deal with them in the morning. We went inside to check on everyone. The girls were all a little frightened, and Little Bit was crying. The fire had scared Mel and Bobby. They asked what was going on, and we told them that the best we could figure, some raiders had hit the neighborhood. What about our house? Mel asked. Two guys were trying to break into the shop, I said. Did they get in? Mel asked, worried. No. Thad and I got there before they could. He's down there now. Danny said he wanted to take a quick ride around the neighborhood. The girls were all against that idea. Taylor and Leanne were scared and didn't want us to leave. I assured them Jeff was out front and no one would get in without some trouble from him. This did little to reassure them, but Danny and I went out and got our ATVs, heading for the gate. We told Jeff what we were going to do. He didn't have a problem staying to keep watch. Danny told him about the other ATV, that he and Thad could take it. Thanks. It'll be nice to have something to get around here on, Jeff said. There were still a bunch of people out, running here and there, shouting, crying. The houses that had been hit were still burning,
casting orange light on nearby houses and creating dancing demons in the trees. We found Mark sitting in his mule in the road down from Danny's with a group of people around him. He was being bombarded with questions, requests, and accusations. He sat there staring into the flames of the house, taking no notice of the verbal assault. We pulled alongside him. The crowd parted as we did.
"What do you think?"
I asked Mark as we eased to a stop. His gaze never shifted. "Looks like we were hit by raiders."
"What are you gonna do about it?"
someone from the crowd shouted. Still looking into the flames, Mark said, "Just what do you think I can do about it?"